Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net has been doing its thing for 38 years, since 1982, run by the host, Dick, K2RIW. And it's time again for another episode of the Technical Net. As always, I like to remind everyone, if you have any questions of a technical nature but you can't get onto the radio, or if you have topics you want discussed, or you want to offer me some puzzlers, or you want me to pass on some information to Paul, and who does the space report, about an article or a video or some source that you found, the email address to reach us is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If I discuss any articles tonight, I will post links to them on my link page. Just point your browser to roy.ac2gs.com, and that will take you to my link page, which I update every week. In case you want to chat with some people about the TechNet, we do have a chat room. You can get there, again, by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And if someone you know needs audio access to this technical net, and they don't have Echo Link and they don't have IRLP, and of course, as always, there are archives of the technical net that go as far back as 2006, I believe, September of 2006. And in addition to all those archived episodes of the technical net, there is now a recording archive of Dick K2RIW's Radio Wake Memorial Service that we have. You know, all 7 hours it's listed as. Actually, it's more like 6 hours and 20 minutes, but it's in hourly bits. So if you missed the Radio Wake, it is available on my KC2NJI site, amateurradio.tv, and please avail yourselves or listen to some of the older versions of the technical net. The information is still pertinent. So let's begin with this episode of the Limark Technical Net. If any, feel free, give me your call sign and your first name.
Steve, KC2, Mike Delta Papa.
Corp?
Yeah, Steve, recognize someone else wants to put their name on the list?
Roger. Kilo Delta 2, or Romeo Mike Delta, Russell and Corp.
Okay, Russell, I got you down. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
K2GJE, Ed, over.
Okay, Ed, I have you on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Put themselves on the list. Just give me your first name and your call sign. Good. We have four people already. So, Steve, could you give me your call sign just one more time, please, Steve?
Yeah, certainly no problem. It's Kilowatt Charlie 2, Mike Delta. This went out to the entire net. Okay, let me, how do I explain? Okay, good watts out, which is not the case. It's more like maybe 200 if it does that. Well, anyway, I was running, you know, set the whole thing up, checked SWR on the input from the radio to the amp. From the amp to the antenna, everything was pretty good, about 1.5 highest. And all of a sudden, I noticed the relay and the amp chattering on single sideband, and did a couple of more tests. It was working, and then, needless to say, I think it fried the finals in my FT817. My question is you know, is it possible for the RF power on the amp to come back into the you know, into the radio? Because I did, you know, I took a junky 10-meter radio and I hooked it up, and I was getting the same thing. And what I noticed on the meter is, for like a brief second, when you unkeyed, that the meter, the power meter, would jump up to like 20 watts, which sort of confused me. I mean, should this happen? Is maybe it's just because it's a cheap amp? I mean, I only paid like $180 for the amp, and it seems in the long run I'm paying for my mistake here. So I'll throw it out to the net, and you guys, any information, any ideas, be greatly appreciated. So I have some sort of idea what went wrong here. Back to you guys.
To the audience as well, but I wonder if we could get just a couple little bit more bits of facts. You have an RM Italy amplifier. Would it be the LA250, or is it an older discontinued model?
No, the thing is brand new. I don't have the model number. I can go look for it if you want. I can give you the exact model number.
Fanless design, or it has two pancake fans stuck on the top?
Yeah, it's probably the same same principle. This one is actually the KL7505.
Okay, I mean, my RM Italy is decent. It's rated supposedly, very theoretically, at 250 or 190 watts. Anything past that, and the safety circuits squeal like a pig. So I don't think, unfortunately, it has the power output that the specs would suggest. I would be curious if there's a reason why you got it so cheaply, because if it's anything like the LA250, that goes for about $500 these days. So either you got a great deal, or there's something a little bit fishy about it. It might have some kind of impedance mismatch to it, so that it's reflecting power back under certain circumstances. But I'll throw it out to the audience and ask anyone what they think about this this problem, what they think is going on.
KD2RMD, Russell?
Yes, Russell.
Why, you good evening to the net. I'm familiar with those very low-drive amplifiers, no more than 1 or 2 watts in, and even 2 watts is pushing it. And yes, if the amplifier is out of tune, power can reflect back to the radio. Over.
Okay, that would be the most obvious thing, Steve. Is there any way you can kind of check if that's what might be going on in the front end of that amplifier?
Basically, you know. With, SWR meter and stuff, that's about as far as my knowledge really is. You know, I'm trying to learn as I go along. It seems to be fine, and, you know, 1 or 2 watts, this thing says 10 watts in maximum, and, you know, I was only running it at 5.
Okay, I understand that. It's just that, as Russell also, we're of like minds. The first thing that comes to mind, at least to me and apparently to Russell, is that it sort of depends where you look for the standing wave ratio. If you're putting it between your antenna and your linear amplifier, you're going to get the product of the output of the linear amplifier and not the input impedance of the linear amplifier. So it is theoretically possible that even though the output of the linear amplifier can be a nominal 50 ohms impedance, or you know, work best under those circumstances, it's possible for whatever reason for some problem with a discrete component where the input impedance is something like, say, 10 ohms, where you're getting a 5 to 1 biswah, you're getting reflection of the output power from the driver itself at times, and that's introducing a burnout if the safety features aren't able to kick in because it happens at short intervals. So if anyone else has any bright ideas of what might be going on, please feel free to volunteer them.
Brian Tawio, that amplifier is made for FM service. That's why the relay is chattering. There's no delay.
Okay, that's a good point. Unfortunately, Richie, like I said before, the powers that be don't want you on this repeater. It's not anything personal. That's another question that's good. My LA-250 has a switch. One setting is FM AM. The other is single sideband. Steve, is there a switch like that on your amplifier? And if so, have you set it to... well, the big question is, what are you transmitting that causes this? If it's FM, then that shouldn't be an issue at all. But, Steve, what are you transmitting when this thing happens? A single sideband or FM?
Okay. Well, when I first got the amplifier, I set it up on FM. It does have a switch. It's AM, FM, top position. And then it's got like a sideband delay, middle position for like 8/10 of a second. And then the bottom is a sideband delay for like 1.2 seconds. So, yeah, FM setup in FM mode. It seemed, you know, to work good, no relay chatter. You know, went to, you know, check SWR, input, output, the whole nine yards. Everything seemed fine. Went to sideband. It was working okay. Then the relay started to chatter. I dropped it down to a longer delay. I dropped the power of the amp down because it's also got a third switch that, you know, it's like high, medium, low power for the output of the amp. And, you know, like I said, all of a sudden the thing started chattering, and I noticed no more output on my FT817. I also, and I said, I used another old 10-meter radio. And I was keying it up, and you'd see the, you know, the meter on the power supply basically, you know, go up to around 20, 25 amps, and no output on the amp at all. Bottom line, it was just, you know, curiosity has got the better of me.
Okay, very good, Steve. Well, you know, if they tell you what was the problem, a lot of these companies, if you send it back, they just... You're lucky if they just send you your refund and be done with it. But if they tell you anything of what the problem was, please come back and tell us as well. There's someone else, I think, that's just kind of triggering the repeater, but I don't hear an audio output. So if there's someone who's trying to join in on the conversation, and if anyone else has any good suggestions, please join us, assuming that you have a license and a call sign. So if there's anyone out there who has any further suggestions about Steve's situation, I think ultimately you'll solve it by returning it. But please, anyone with any ideas, transmit your name and your call sign.
WA2CDL with a question.
Andy.
I wasn't listening to the first part. I was outside. What's the problem with an amplifier? If he wants to explain it again, I can maybe give a suggestion, because I missed the first part. I don't know what the issue is.
Andy. Problem.
I'll be out in the car.
Well, Andy, I don't know. Steve might have walked away. The problem, as he stated it, was he has an RM Italy amplifier. Out the spring ultimately do you have any idea that had read a good that was with
okay, stand by a second.
Okay, if I can get through it. Steve, KC2MDP, was discussing that he had a Yaesu 817. He was feeding it, I think it goes up to maybe 10 watts. He was feeding it with 5 watts into a RM Italy high-gain linear amplifier. It was spec'd supposedly for 300 watts, but probably not more than 200. And he was noticing that on single sideband settings, he was getting initially a chatter from the relays, no matter what setting he put the, you know, that he had two single sideband settings to kind of delay the relays triggering. And no matter which setting he used, he got the chatter, and then eventually he found out that his 817 power amplifier had just burnt out its transistor, I guess, and so it was powerless. He said that the Vizwa totally was decent, but I'm thinking that that's the Vizwa from the linear amplifier's output to the antenna input.
Yeah, okay. It sounds like you've got the relay is RF controlled. I'm assuming that it takes RF power and rectifies it and keys the relay. And if he's got a bad cable where his SWR is cable is open or high SWR between the antenna, no, between the amplifier and his 817. That's number one. And number two, if it's not seeing enough RF level, the relay will chatter. It's seeing a little bit of RF, but not enough signal strength to hold the relay in. Not enough signal power, I should say. That's what it sounds like, and it sounds like possibly he damaged his 817 because he wasn't going into a proper load, which would be the amplifier. What do you think?
Okay, that sounds reasonable, but I'm not completely familiar with Yaesu 817s. I would assume that it has a fold-over ability so that it wouldn't cause that much problem if it was just hooked up to even an open circuit.
KC2MDP.
Okay, MDP. All right, very good. I'll give it to you in a second. I think it's Steve. Yeah, that's true too. Yes, if the SWR is high, then the power would fall back. That's right. It should anyway. Let me give it to you, Leroy. Let me give it back to you, Roy, and you can pick up MDP.
Okay, this is AC2GS. It is a very intermittent open. It might screw around with the protection circuit. There might be some transient point where it takes a finite amount of time for it to initiate foldover. So maybe it was just too smart for its own good. But Steve, you want to add something?
Yeah, I'll add a couple of more words here. As far as the input from the 817 to the amplifier, I did check the SWR on that, and it was about 1.5, maybe on the higher end, 28.5 or so. It was maybe about 1.7, 1.8. I tried to stay in the lower end, 28.3 to about 28.4. As far as the cable, that is a good scenario. But once I had this problem, I was using my ICOM IC7000, puts out 100 watts in the same application from the radio to my meter, and without the amp to the antenna, and I didn't have a problem. So that sort of tells me that it wasn't anything with the cable. And like I said, I used the second radio. I had an old Radio Shack HTX something or other 10 meter radio, And I'm thinking, you know what, if I burn this one up, it's not a great loss. I already killed a $500-plus radio. Well, anyway, I hooked that one up, and basically the same thing was happening. You'd see the amplifier draw power, no output as far as wattage coming out of the amplifier. Then I reversed the whole thing, put the SWR meter on the input from the radio to the amp, and when you'd unkey the radio, you'd see that needle jump to like almost 20 watts. So that's telling me that somehow power is getting back into the radio. Back to you guys.
Question?
Yeah, go ahead. Andy, what's your question?
That was not me. That was somebody else who asked questions. Okay, KD2RMD. The ASU 817, on the minimum power, all right, on minimum power, what is the peak power that that radio does on single sideband? Because if it's between 30 and 40 watts, that's a bit high for that amplifier. Over.
Now, that radio only puts out 5 watts.
Hey, Roger on that.
Steve?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Andy CDL. I was trying to follow what you just said. What do you mean by power? When you unkeyed, you saw power coming back to the 817. Could you explain that?
Sure, best of my ability. Okay, I have my diamond, whatever it is, SX100, 1000, whatever it is, from the 817 into the SWR meter, SWR power meter, and then from that it was going into the amplifier, from the amplifier directly to the antenna. This Radio Shack 10 meter rig hooked up to it. I was running about 5 watts also, and basically I key the radio, you see the power spike in the Astron power supply, no power coming out of the amplifier. Basically what I put into the amplifier seemed to be coming out of the amplifier. And when I let go of the mic, you'd see the needle, the power needle spike. It would like jump to like the 20 watt level for like a brief second.
I still had trouble following what you said. Can you look, instead of tying this up, can you give me a call on the phone?
Yeah, certainly.
All right, because I don't want to tie up the tech mix with this. Because I want to get an explanation of what's going on. Can you do me a favor? Could you look me up on QRZ and send me an email with your phone number, and I'll call you?
You got it, no problem.
All right, my call, WA2 Commercial Driver's License, CDL. My email address is posted on QRZ. Just send me an email. When I get it, I'll call you.
Okay, thank you, Andy. I greatly appreciate it.
All right, I got to get back to what I was doing before it gets dark. Roy, thank you, Roy, WA2 CDL. I'm clear for now.
You're welcome, Andy, and Steve, I wish you luck, and please, if you come to some resolution with this, drop by again and tell us how the story ends, okay, Steve?
That I most certainly, definitely will, because I'm just as curious as probably everybody else out there at this point as what's going on.
Okay, very good, Steve. So 73, please listen along, and we thank you for your participation. Next on my list is Russell. Russell, what's your question for tonight?
My outside HF article, I went with the MFJ-1979. It's a telescopic whip antenna that expands to a total height of 16.5 feet tall. And then you can shorten it for 17, 15, 12, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, my signal report's coming back with it. I made four contacts earlier in the week. It was just local contacts around East Canada, the Midwest, and then one contact out to Washington State. The Washington State gave me like a better signal report of a 5.5, and we held a quick queue. So I'm just wondering if anyone is familiar with telescopic whip antennas and if they've had similar experiences. The antenna itself is mounted onto a mobile mounting bracket, which I have attached to a ground rod. I'm using an aluminum sheet as the radio plate, something that I homebrewed myself, and I have a total of 16 radials, ground-mounted radials, that extend out. 12 of the radials are 18 feet long. 12 of the radials are 18 feet long, so it's a four-quarter wavelength on 20 meters. I have four that I was able to fit in my small lot outside my front door, between 12 and 10 feet long. So I'm just wondering, is it because it's a steel? Is that why the signals are marginal? Or if anyone has had similar experiences with that antenna? Or
okay, Russell, very good. I'll ask people their opinion. Telescoping antennas are not a very common thing, other than, you know, maybe with handy talkies in the old days.
Yeah, come on, Kevin.
Corrosion doesn't set in when it's a fresh new antenna. It's probably functional. I don't think it would probably age well. As the elements kind of get into the different segments, you might develop oxidation, which causes them to act as though they're nonlinear devices and be sources of noise and all kinds of problems. But I would be just as curious as you if anyone out there had played around with telescoping elements. In the case of Russell, he has a ground plane quarter wave design that utilizes it. I would appreciate if anyone has any comments about the utilization of a collapsible telescoping whip antenna for external use.
WB2AA, okay.
Situation, so it has to be stealthy. So I don't leave that antenna outside. When I'm done, I sit down, I unscrew it, and then I put a flower pot over the feed point, and nobody sees. So it's convenient. I can throw it on and, you know, expand it out, collapse it. But it doesn't look like anyone was coming back with any knowledge of that antenna. But I'll keep trying with it. You know, it could have just been bad propagation that day. I was just using my dipole antenna, and I was having a QSO with Serbia. So, you know, I wanted to propagation, or if the horizontal is not giving me too much results on one particular day, I could switch over to the vertical antenna just to see.
Yeah, Russell, I'm a big fan for multiple antennas. I've mentioned it before on this technical net. I kind of operate, especially on 10 meters, in diversity mode. I have a stereo 5/8 wave ground plane vertical, and I also have a fan dipole for 80 to 10. And I feed one into my left ear and one into my right ear, and it's been educational at the very least. Chester, WB2AHK, though, I think wanted to say something on the subject. So, Chester, please.
Okay, very good. This is Chester. I just want to say particularly I operate HF every day, and 20, 40, and 80, and conditions have been, I know anyway, in the last 3 or 4 days have been pretty poor on 20 meters in general. I mean, you get out and all, but last week bands were great, and then this week things have been noticeably poor, so this might not be a good week to do a testing on an antenna. The station said that he had a dipole and was doing good, and that's notable. But in general, I noticed the conditions were poor in the last few days, so not conducive to doing testing. That's my opinion. Over.
Okay, thank you very much, Chet. I realize that you know, different meter, different bands have different characteristics as time goes on. Today, for anyone interested, the 10-meter band was interesting, more interesting than usual. There was a little apparent sporadic E going on. I host a 10-meter net in the morning on Sundays, and we got a contact from Indiana, which was a nice change of pace. Usually on a good day we get one from Florida. We had two people from Florida and one people from Indiana, so sporadic E seems to be. And Chet, as long as you're in this conversation, have you ever had any real experience with using telescoping whips of any kind as external antenna elements, and have you noticed any problems with corrosion and weathering on such structures?
I can't say I do. Not on HF. Just about everybody who's been a ham for a while has run into the use of telescoping whips. But generally speaking, for you know, higher frequency bands, the VHF and UHF, I've been a ham for 58 years, and all that time I probably built 50 antennas at least. 4HF, maybe more, 100 antennas, but never used that type of construction, so I can't offer any ideas on that. Go ahead.
Okay, Chad, I thought as long as you were part of the conversation, I would try my best. I understand that stealth antennas are a sub-subject in and of themselves. You optimize its non-obvious nature, and if that is a partial detriment to the functionality, so be it, because you don't want to frighten the neighbors too much. I'm sure it was, though, a much more difficult problem many years ago when the television bands were not digital and they were on frequencies that could be, develop a problem with HF users. But I understand, Russell, that you want to be stealthy, and I wish you well. And if you find that it was just local propagation for the last short period of time, and you get better performance, please consider coming back and telling us how the story ended.
Roger, thank you much. This is Russell. I'll operate using that antenna for the next few weeks, and I'll check back in next week. I'll let you know what type of contacts I made on it. If it turns out to be a marginal antenna, I can always shorten it for some other bands that I don't have dipoles for. But the dipoles in my attic are still performing quite well. In fact, I had a couple of new countries a couple hours ago on 20 meters. I had Serbia for the first time, and it's a lot higher. On my 20-meter dipole, I usually have a 3 and 4 noise level. On that vertical, it was at a steady at 7 on 20 meters. So that's another thing. It was a lot of the contact hearing was in the mud. But what are you going to do? So, all right, KD2RMZ, I'll let everyone know how it works out next week.
Okay, very good, Russell. And you have to keep in mind that as a generalization, and ultimately, all generalizations are ultimately wrong in special conditions. Verticals tend to be a little bit more noisier. They tend to have a higher background noise level than horizontally oriented antenna structures. And there's a bunch of different reasons, and one of them is to a degree that the dissipation of local electrical noise favors horizontally polarized antennas versus vertically. So you'll probably, even the finest vertical that you could come up with, you'll notice that for that orientation just gives you a little bit more background noise. But that's a rather big difference between the two. So I wish you luck, and hope that you come back and tell us the rest of the story. Next on my list is Ed, K2GJE. You have a question or a topic for discussion tonight, Ed?
question, just a topic. First, I know you like to know how things work and how they don't work and how they sometimes cause some great problems. I just finished reading a book called Humble Pie, Pie spelled P-I, not P-I-E, by Matt Parker. He's an Australian now living in England. So first, have you read the book, over?
No, I have not. Do you recommend it?
Yes, I do. The thing that was most interesting to me, it's more of a computer problem. Most of today's machines are operating on 64 bits, but machines, old machines, or hardware operating on 32 are going to fail at 3:14 a.m. on Tuesday, January 19th, 2038. Now, this is not something over the internet. This is not something I heard on 20 meters. This is from a book from a programmer. And the reason for it, I'll go into in just a second. Over. Okay, I just didn't know if I was timing out. The way computers were originally set up to give the time of day and date, they filled up all the bits with ones, and they count down. The problem, obvious, is a 32-bit system is going to count down faster than a 64-bit system. When a 64-bit system counts down to zero, none of us are going to be alive. But when 32-bit systems count down to zero and really crash, it's going to happen in 2038. And there may be some old equipment out there operating on the old system, programmable controllers, refrigerators, stoves, washing machines, things possibly on the power grid. I don't know. What's your opinion, over?
AC2GS. Well, Ed, it sounds like a bit of a corollary to the old Y2K problem, in which they had hard-coded the last two digits of the year without thinking about what happens in the year 2000 and plus. So I could sort of understand why this is going to be a big problem, although my gut sense is, especially the way that modern equipment is designed these days, that it will make it to 2038 is highly unlikely. I guess some people might be able to keep their equipment running, so I'm going to have to do a little bit more research into this. I don't know if you're aware, but Microsoft, I think, is kind of doing away. In the old days, you could get their operating system, their latest and greatest operating system, for both 32-bit and 64-bit architecture. But I think they've made an announcement that they're going to discontinue offering 32-bit upgrades to their operating system. So I think everything's going to move over to 64-bit architecture. So that's a fascinating thing. I don't know what exactly they would call it, the Y2.038K.
I don't think they have a name for it. I think there were some patches for the Y2K problem. It seems that there were no problems. I don't know why it was not capable of switching from 19 to 20. I don't know. And I don't know why a system that fails can't be restarted, but I'm not a computer expert. I think this may be something to discuss on the computer net. But the book, in general, is very interesting reading. I'm suggesting that you get your hands on it. There's a lot of other things in it. Back to that, over.
Okay, very well, Ed. Thank you. I appreciate all recommendations. Last week, someone recommended a Harvard professor's book on electronics. It was basically a course-level handbook. It's 1,400 pages, and I just was thumbing through it, and I have to figure out if I have a month or so to read this thing. But I always like to get new books and read new stuff. As far as the programming, you know, these things are just sort of written in the programs themselves. You can make variables out of anything. You could make them out of integers, floating points, extended floating points, and when they were designing the software itself, they decided that who in their life would see the year 2000, and they simply coded those two last trailing digits as the year indicators. If you go back to the software, you can patch it, which wasn't a problem as far as I was aware in present day, you know, BASIC and C and other kind of living code languages. They were having problems with COBOL, which has sort of gone out of fashion to a degree. There are still COBOL and Fortran programmers, but they hit their peak in the old days of mainframes and such. So with Y2K, they were snapping up semi-retired COBOL and Fortran programmers so that they could design software patches into those old bits of software so that when the date stamp flipped up to zero, it didn't confuse itself and lock up in a loop.
I guess there's probably a patch for this problem, too, if these old systems an everyday occurrence. It could be even a computer in a machine. A lot of machines now are not wired the way we used to do wiring. Just to turn on a light, the power goes to the computer, the switch goes to the computer, the light goes to the computer, and the light makes the decision. And that's what's happening in most of our cars to make them very, very complicated. Let me just play. As far as antennas, usually corrosion isn't a problem until there's some time down the line. But what I've said before, I don't care what antenna you build, as long as you get the SWR down, that I believe so much in SWR meters. That's all we had years ago. As long as you get the SWR down, it's going to radiate, as Dick always used to tell us. I've built a lot of different antennas, and the difference, I think, always is the lobes that they make. I had some very unusual antennas. I had a 20-meter antenna that was three half waves long, and I set it a quarter wave from one end, and that worked fantastically. So there's a lot of antennas that are not in the book. As long as the SWR is down, it'll work. You're just going to have different lobes. Over.
Yeah, Ed, I agree with you, and I agree with Dick K2RIW. First you resonate, and then you radiate. The problem is that antenna efficiencies is a factor. It's a little bit more difficult to discern because you have to do a practical field test, which is much more difficult than just slapping a VISWA meter onto your antenna system. And as you mentioned, the radiation pattern can be very important. You know, sometimes it's not, but sometimes it is. And as you change the antenna, you modify the nodes, and you develop high power in some places in three-dimensional space, and not so much radiation in other places, and you have to concern yourself with the takeoff angle of the antennas and what you have, what you're planning to use them for. If you want a near vertical incident sky wave, it's one thing, and if you want a DX that propagates past the horizon, that's another one. So the first thing, as I agree with you and with Dick, that VISWA is very important. But ultimately, in addition, you need something a little extra because, you know, people know that a dummy load is a can be a one-to-one match, but that doesn't make it a great antenna.
I don't have any other words of wisdom tonight. I don't know who else is on the list, over.
Okay, Ed, that's fine. I thank you for your participation tonight in providing a topic for discussion, and I hope you'll come back and do it again in future episodes of the Technical Net.
WF2N.
Yes, Paul.
I brought this up on the computer, and there's a whole story about it on a website called The Guardian. I've read The Guardian before, so I know they're okay. So it's all about that topic. And, it goes on and on. I'll send it to you, Roy. This way you don't have to buy the book right away. But it has to do with that year 2028 and the time. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Paul. I'd appreciate it. Maybe I'll even put it up on the website link page so people can read it as well. Unfortunately, we don't take a long view picture of anything. So even when the Y2K problem, which thankfully turned out to be nothing because everyone was worried enough about it that they took measures to lessen the side effects. But to tell people that you have to quickly, it'll be interesting to see exactly the response if you change the time frame. At what interval of time will people actually get off out of their chair and start to actually look at the problem and address it? So it may be a problem as well that it's 18 years in our future. The link, and I will share it with the rest of them. Next up is Rich, W2BZ. What's your question for tonight, Rich?
Before I get into the question, I took your advice and I de-weatherized my microphone. Can you tell me if there's anything wrong with it or does it sound okay?
It sounds fine. It still is low signal. If you had a higher setting on your mic preamp, I suggest you put it up. I can't tell you if it got any louder with that little mini surgical procedure. My assumption is probably not, though.
Okay. Second question is, did you bump the EQ at all on your end as we were talking about?
Yes, I did, Rich. I am a man of my word.
Well, it sounds it. Let me just put it that way. Okay. So my question, this is about digital radio, specifically about DMR radio. When you're using a DMR radio with a hotspot, you come up against something called channel information or channels. Each channel has two frequencies. A receive frequency and a transmit frequency. Now, those frequencies are the two frequencies of the repeater, are they not?
Well, it's the two frequencies of whatever you're communicating with. If it's if you're directly communicating with your handy-talkie to a local repeater, yes, it's the repeater. If you're talking to your hotspot, then you're not operating duplex or even half duplex, you're operating simplex, and both frequencies are the same frequency, and they're the frequency you already set for the hotspot to receive and transmit on.
Okay, but I've seen some channels that have two different frequencies. That's what's confusing to me.
that would be for a repeater. Most repeaters have an input frequency and an output frequency. They operate half duplex, so you would see a difference. There's that split that pretty much all repeaters presently have. In the future, this might not be possible with time slicing and such. It might be possible to actually slice time segments off and obviate the need for a duplexer and multiple frequencies. But that's something perhaps in the future of digital modes. Right now, repeaters require an input and an output frequency.
But I don't see any up when the channel page comes up that you can tell, other than there are two different frequencies, that you're dealing with a repeater that has two frequencies, as opposed to, let's say, the jumbo spot that only has one frequency.
Well, it depends upon the software. There is software out there that will do the calculation. If you put in, say, its input frequency and then define its split, it will calculate its output frequency. A lot of CPS software is basically designed in China, and I think one guy wrote the basic one, and everyone else has been tweaking and changing it. Usually what they do is they simply have two different number fields for frequencies, and if it's a simplex operation using a hotspot or a simplex operation with your neighbor, you put in the same frequency in both receive and transmit, and if you're dealing with a repeater with an offset, you include the two different frequencies in those two number fields. I believe there is also a checkbox to check simplex mode and duplex mode. I don't know if that's a generic thing or just the CPS software that I'm familiar with.
If there is a checkbox, which I don't see on this one channel, but if there is a checkbox and you're using a Pi Star, which one would you check?
AC2GS. I would check simplex. It is a single frequency device. It is either receiving your signal on that frequency or transmitting a signal to you on that frequency. It is never repeating the signal at a different frequency, so it does not require half duplex operation or duplexing filters or anything fancy like that. So it's a simplex operation with a single frequency in and out.
Okay, and the last question then is, for each channel that you want to use, for each channel that you want to set up, you have to conform that frequency to the Pi Star, because you can't change the Pi Star for every channel you want to set up. You have to change the channels, you have to change the frequency in the channels, right? For every channel you want to use, and you have to do that manually, is that correct?
Unfortunately, yes. No one's gone to the point where they're writing programs specifically for CPS-like programs for hotspots, in which it'll hold on to a variable that it might call hotspot, and if you just selected that as opposed to a series of frequencies, it would just throw your hotspot into that frequency. But at this point, unfortunately, you have to get into the habit. You could do it as a macro and just do a lot of cut and pasting. Or if you have a friend, you could use their code plug, or you can finagle a comma separated variable file and import it.
Okay, probably paste batch file would be the smartest way to go, because the only frequency that you're dealing with is one frequency. Let's say it's 440.8. The frequency of the Pi Star is the one frequency you'd be changing in each channel, correct? If you had to, if it wasn't there already. If you had to, the one frequency you'd be changing, there are no other frequencies to change. Is that correct?
Yeah, the channel table only gives you access to two different numeric frequencies, the input, the output. So both of them are the same for the Pi Star, so that would be the only frequency change to make for any channel. You know, most people tend to either cut and paste or just write it from scratch when they're doing channels that are specifically hotspot oriented, because they usually want to keep their repeater-based channels accessible in case they, you know, don't have the hotspots or don't have internet and they still want to go on RF. But you could do it the other way. But yeah, the only two frequency fields in most channel information windows is the input and output frequency.
In the Pi Star, you know, once you see the Pi Star dashboard or the admin panel, however you want to say it, once you set that frequency, that doesn't change. That's your frequency, right?
Correct. Once you put it in the configuration file for your Zoom Spot or Jumbo Spot or any of those, it's basically locked in. You would have to kind of have the software go bad, which happens, unfortunately. Raspberry Pis do have a tendency at times to corrupt their SD card, and then you'd have to reflash it and rewrite your particular unique entries into your configuration file. But all things being equal, as long as it's running, it should keep in memory the frequency that you've set it to receive and transmit on.
Okay. The difference between, let's say, Maryland statewide or Maryland all state and New York all state, or let me put it an easier way. What's the difference between Maryland Cat 10 and New York Cat 10?
If it's truly TAC 310, then it's the same exact talk group. Talk groups are identified by their ID number. They have a unique identifier, the same way that DMR allows for personal identifiers. That's the long 6 or 7 digit number that DMR MARC or radio ID has given everyone. And ID number is usually in the small digits category are talk group ID numbers. So it depends upon the identifier number. If one state has a TAC 310 that uses an identifier 310 and another state has a TAC 310 that uses an ID of 310, then you should be able to go to yet a third state and plug in ID 310 and receive both of their transmissions.
Right, so you don't even need to do 50, right? Maryland, New York, Pennsylvania, TAC 10. All you have to do is one TAC 10 channel, correct?
Yes, assuming that they're all ID 310, they're all ID 310. If they're doing strange things with the naming nomenclature, and you know, Maryland has decided to call something 310, and if you look up its ID, it's actually say 4310 instead of 310. Then all bets are off, and they just are confusingly renaming things in a way that's going to cause more problems than they solve. But assuming if you look up say Maryland TAC 310. And find out what its ID number is, and it says 310, then it's the same TAC 310 as any other place in the world.
Okay, and the channel name then is just arbitrary. So if I put Richie TAC 10, TAC 310 in one channel, and in another channel I put Bobby TAC 310, it's still going to be just 310, correct?
Yes. The text identifier is only used locally. It doesn't do anything with the packets of audio that are pumped through the internet.
The thing that makes or breaks it is the way that you list the contact list. There's a text portion of the contact list, which is a descriptor that you could write Mickey as Pitalik, as long as the part that says ID number is the right ID number.